ったりとか。
あ、アファルムシャツのビーフレーム。うん。
I don't usually start till 4:15. Easier traffic.
It's the special work session today, is Monday, April 23rd, 2025, and the time is 5:30.
Yes, Mr. Heck.
Here.
Mr. Jenkins.
Here.
Mrs. Myers.
Here.
Mrs. Tarassi.
Here.
Mrs. Vincent.
Here.
Mrs. Williams.
Here.
Mr. Zimmerman.
Here.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
So next is the discussion items, and
very much, sir.
All right, so our first item we have on the agenda is the seat committee recommendation. So a few weeks ago, that was brought in by David and Chuck, and so there's been some conversation since then, so I wanted to give everyone an opportunity to the conversation. I do, in your packet, you are going to see information from David in there, and it has to do with the opt-in process that currently you're required to use. In the past, it was an opt-out, but it's an opt-in. And so if the parent's child doesn't take it back at home, parents don't sign it, child doesn't take part. So it's leaving it in the hands of.
I guess for the sake of time's sake, I know a board member asked about HPV rates in Michigan and in Monroe County specifically. So I did provide you in your packets with a hard copy that is colored. Sorry, I will try to cut back. It is a colored copy, and then I also provided you partly. I also provided you with a nice write-up of what I believe Stacy asked about at our last meeting regarding cancer rates and vaccination rates. So she provided a little bit more detail. And I would like to say, you know, everyone knows how to read a graph, but I went to the experts, so I made sure I could interpret the graphs on these sheets. So, Darla, you asked about vaccination rates in Monroe County. And the best information I can give you is in the lightly shaded blue on the bottom of the first page, which is, it's not just our youth, it is everyone in Monroe County, men and women. The graph on the bottom left of the bottom right of the front sheet, which has Monroe County vaccination rates by gender. 2018, and we are that light blue 20-40%. What I believe Stacy asked about, I think, was how effective the vaccination, the HPV vaccination is in preventing cancer. And for that, there is a graph, which is the bottom graph on the back sheet right above that blue bar. And basically how to interpret that graph. There is an arrow just to the left of it, and it says the 9-valent HPV vaccine protects against the 7 high-risk HPV types that cause most HPV-related cancers. With this vaccine, 722 cancer cases attributed to HPV in females and 469 in males could have been prevented. So what they're saying is in the roughly 1,500, which correlates to this number right here, the 1,500 HPV associated cancers in Michigan, that, trying to get my numbers right, 76% of those could have been covered by the vaccination. So the vaccination covers against 7 types, and 722 in females, 469 in males could have been prevented. there are 40 strands of HPV. The vaccine protects 7. But those percentages are pretty significant. What I think is interesting and what I really like that she did is down here at the bottom of this page in gray, it says HPV positive not covered by the vaccine. There's still HPV-associated cancer cases that are not covered by the 9-valent vaccine. This means that the vaccine can be expanded to cover more. And then on the back, in yellow, you have 141 and 176 in male cases that were not HPV negative. So there were cases of cancer that were HPV negative. This means that there are other factors other than HPV that contributed to cancer development. Some questions that you may have, why is Monroe County so low? Well, the data is fairly new on that because the vaccine's only been readily available the past 20 years. So I know that's a lot of facts or a lot of statistics, a lot of facts. I'll do my best to answer any questions that you have on that part. Mr. Heck, I can see you formulating a thought.
What I've read, the vaccine is a 3-shot system?
To be completely covered, yes. So you'll actually, that's a very good question. You'll actually see that on the very first graph on the top right, where if you scroll all the way over, it tells you what percentage, once we get to the middle in the blue, of who is covered. So 60%, 67% of females, 64% of males had at least one shot. But again, in Michigan, in our youth, 13 to 17-year-olds, only 51% of females are complete, only 47% of males are complete. So there's a lot of statistics, there's a lot of variables. I know this cited a 7-variant HPV vaccine, but now we know it protects against 9 strands of the HPV. So, again, I know it's a lot of information. Happy to answer any questions, but I did want to hit on something that Andy brought up about our opt-in letter. Currently, we have 7 policies that give parents the right to, I guess, pull their student from class if something is controversial. 2240, controversial issues. 2270, religion in the curriculum. 2413, critical health issues. 2414, reproductive health and family planning. 2416, student privacy and parental access to information, and that includes curriculum information. 2418, sex ed, and 9250, relations with parents. So currently our teachers provide a letter stating what's going to be presented in sex ed. And parents
and... We teach sex ed right now.
We teach.
What are we teaching in sex ed?
Abstinence and reproduction.
Yeah, but that's part of the health curriculum that we approved.
I believe we teach sex ed based on 2414 and 2418. That's what I believe.
So my understanding was the information that's being, because I asked this question at a previous meeting, so the information that we're presenting today is the first information that's being brought forth to the board for approval under the seat as related to teaching sex in school. And I specifically asked that question, what has been taught up until now? And the answer was abstinence, besides the health videos that we approved, and the HIV and AIDS. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm curious to know now, what are we teaching then? Because abstinence is abstinence. How do you teach sex ed? Like, what are we teaching under sex ed? I don't know that. So I asked that question, and it said no. Because I said the SEVA hasn't done anything in a year, and it never brought anything forward, and said, no, this is the first step we're bringing forward.
In accordance with Michigan statute, the Board of Education, no, I'm reading from 2418, authorizes instruction in sex education. Such instruction may include family planning, human sexuality, and the emotional, physical, psychological, hygienic, economic, and social aspects of family life. I will say that some of those things are included when we talk about at-risk behavior. unintended consequences of unplanned pregnancy.
So in that, there's also under the CEVE that the curriculum must be approved by the board. So the CEVE generates their information to put together the curriculum that then comes to the board. That's how the CEVE process works. That's what the whole point of an advisory board is. It says, this is the information we would like to teach. We're going to bring that information to the board because you have to get board approval, which is where we're at now.
Sure.
So we haven't done that for anything else since that went in place, because I literally asked that question because I was pretty confident that nothing had been done, because that's why I asked, how many meetings did you have?
Well,
like, what was the purpose of the meetings?
I couldn't tell you the historical nature way back when of what was purchased or approved.
I'm going from when I started on here, and that's my context is going from there.
Right.
The CEVE did not get started until just the previous year.
Right.
It was when it got voted in.
The board established the CEVE.
It had to be voted in.
Yep.
The CEVE meets and brings the curriculum that they would like to teach as part of the sex ed curriculum to the board. That's where we're at now. And you guys said, well, we chose the two topics that we thought would be the most
safe.
Yep. And so these are the two that you picked. So if there has been other stuff that has been taught outside of this process, I'd be curious to know what that is.
There is not any.
You said it was.
I believe sex education includes reproduction, abstinence.
As health class, because we approved those health videos, and in all of those health videos, remember the one that for the high school, and it was talking about the health people going to different parties and going to all that kind of stuff. Remember that? That was part. That was the HIV one.
Right.
So that hit it on those topics, and we said that was fine because of the way it was being presented was saying, hey, there's things going on in the world and whatnot. But there has been no discussion of anything else that has been brought up that they're teaching sex to kids. And so if there is, I'd like to know what it is, because we don't have a curriculum. The curriculum that was approved was a health curriculum. It's for HIV and AIDS. Nothing else has been approved since the CEVE, for sure.
Yeah, nothing has been approved.
So we cannot be teaching sex ed.
I understand that the CEVE was formally established under some members of this board, but I can't speak to what happened prior to that. My understanding is that our board has established that we are an abstinence-only district.
So
sex education.
So again, I'm just going by what you said today.
Sure.
And I said, you said we're teaching sex ed. And I said, if that's true, what are we teaching? Because it can't be the health class, it can't be the curriculum that was already approved, it can't be HIV and AIDS. The CEVE goes beyond that, and we all know that. That's why the state said, you do not have to teach sex ed. No school is required to teach sex ed. You have to teach HIV and AIDS, you have to teach human reproduction, you have to teach all that, but sex ed is not a required class. But if you want to teach
it... human reproduction fall under sex?
Not according to the state when they put this together about the CEVE, and it says you don't have to teach this. These are the things under the CEVE where you can go beyond what's taught in health class. Now, you taught reproduction, you teach how women, you know, you get babies and the sperm and the egg and all that kind of stuff. Those are all the things that are currently done. This CEVE takes it beyond that. And that's why the state said, you can't teach any of this unless you form a CEVE. So we didn't have one. So last year, voted to put a CEVE in, and that was part of the policy that went in. So when the policy went in and got approved, that was the declaration for the CEVE. The CEVE met, I think twice, we discussed that the last time. When you met, this is what you brought forward. So if we were teaching sex ed in schools, that would be outside of what has been approved by a curriculum just since we've been here.
Well, I think we're arguing semantics. Like,
right.
I
just said sex ed.
No, I don't know, but I think that's probably not the good verbiage to use, because what's being taught today is in the health class, right?
Yes.
So it's strictly following the health aspects.
I don't know. I have to go back and look at our board-approved 2418 sex education policy, where it says before adopting any revisions in the materials or methods used in instruction under this policy, including but not limited to revisions to provide the teaching of abstinence from sex as a method of preventing unplanned or out-of-wedlock pregnancy and sexually transmitted disease, or child abuse to public hearings. And, you know, that's what we are teaching. And the CEVE is proposing a change to that, which is barrier protection. And so, like, I 100% understand your perspective. I believe we are teaching sex education. I'm not on the board, but based on this policy, I'm interpreting that we are an abstinence-only, abstinence-based district when it comes to teaching sex education. That's just my perspective.
So how do you teach sex ed? I think you're talking about
a sex ed class for health class. It's already done through health class.
But he's saying we're teaching sex education through health. And I just said, what does that look like? Like, what does that mean? I don't know what that means. I truly don't. I'm just looking for clarification on what that means.
So I know what happened a little bit prior to leave. I think before the actions that took place on education to more formally establish the CEVE in accordance to all the policies, I believe Dr. Ray and Megan Chantal and myself, we led what we interpreted the CEVE to be.
So we had some meetings with what we had in our state committee at the time. There were some newer health books that were approved a while ago, and it did have two abstinence. Like, that is the way that our district approaches sex education, is it's an abstinence of helping kids to make decisions. But that's all that we have in terms of what is currently done. So what's currently done is what was done by previous boards in the adoption of a health curriculum.
When I came on, it was called the Sex Ed Committee. It was no C. And literally at the table was the health department, like all healthcare people, like there was a whole array of people. So it was like, what is currently being discussed in health class? Are we hitting the main topics of things that are coming up, the new things that are popping up that need to be addressed and whatnot? Nutrition was part of it. I could get my notes. I may have them if I got it.
My letter right here says, health curriculum includes lessons on nutrition, physical activity, alcohol, tobacco, other drugs, safety, social and emotional health, personal health and wellness, HIV prevention, and sex education.
Those are the
sentence. Yeah, this is the new. This is new. This isn't old. This is new.
But
this
health, is what health education. The health class has always been health class.
Yeah, it teaches. So again, I'm just trying to find out where we're at, and that was the very first time that I've ever heard anybody say that we taught sex education in the public schools. And so the fact that that's being said, I just said, okay, if this is what you're bringing now, I want to know what's currently being taught as well. I think that's a fair thing to ask.
Can I ask a clarifying question? Being taught in any of our Monroe public schools, is there any content that has not been approved by this board in terms of any sort of HIV, AIDS, human papillomavirus, any sort of intercourse related content, barrier protection content, any sort of birth control content, anything that this board has not previously approved? Is any of that content currently being taught in our school district?
No, I would reference the slides that were presented, which says what we're not touching, and what we're not touching is things that we do not teach. And that includes IUDs, pills, birth control, spermicides, all of those things.
So the content that's currently being taught in Monroe Public Schools are the slides that this board and its previous board iterations approved, and the health curriculum that the board previously approved?
I'm going to clarify mostly, like, right, like there are no slot, like those slides that I think they were color coded on. When it comes to HPV, we talk about HPV as a STI. We don't talk about prevention.
Right.
Because we cannot.
Right.
Correct. And we talk about abstinence to protect yourself from STIs and unwanted, unplanned pregnancy.
Right.
And that's a hard stop currently.
So that's the content that is being taught. So the semantics of, if some people call that sex ed, or if some people call that health class, I feel like that's a matter of opinion for who wants to call what. What is important is the curriculum that was approved by the board is the only thing that is being taught in Monroe Public Schools.
That's my question. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's my question. And that's
You're
just, yes, yeah, that is the question. Well said. And I just want an answer.
And that's only in the health class, correct?
Well, yes, there are some anatomy and physiology classes where taught by a science teacher that talks about reproduction.
Yeah.
But yes.
So I guess
are you answering your question? Is it my question too?
So yes.
I will try my best to answer.
So yes, the answer was yes, that only the content that was approved by this board is what is being taught in our district. That no one is going rogue and teaching content that is, well, what is being proposed is not already implemented. Other content that is not proposed is also not being implemented somewhere else in the district. So only the content that was previously approved. So the slides that were previously approved, the curricula that was previously approved. That's the only content that is currently in front of students for those purposes.
And nothing else. There's the caveat. There is other stuff.
Give me more. What are you looking for?
I want the same answer she wants, and he answered it twice, but anytime he answered it, I said, give me an example. Yes, sex ed is high schools. Give me an example. Is it what we're discussing right now with the videos and the stuff? Are you considering that being sex ed? Because I don't consider that. That's always been health class. This SEEB is sex education, which is mandated by the state, and what can be taught is also included as part of this. This is like legal stuff, right? SEEB is legal.
But it's always...
not can't be outside the law.
So I think there's also... David, you can also jump in and tell me if I'm getting in the weeds. Okay. So when it comes to what you're calling health class, what we were mentioning is sex ed.
That's the sex ed is a two-week Two to 3 week, depending on if you're talking to Mrs. Gates or Chris Clark, that's how long HIV and reproductive, like what I am considering to be sex education is within health class.
So the slides be approved, do you think for reproductives and the HIV slides are sex ed?
They have to go through a process. And they
no, he, I just want to know what's going on to this 2 to 3 week time frame that you consider
reproduction,
sex ed.
Body parts,
so those
body
are the
functions,
videos that we approve.
Fertilization.
So that's all.
All of that has either been approved.
Can we just see it? I just want to know what it is.
Absolutely. I will get you everything that contains to sex ed, what I consider sex ed,
okay.
HIV, STIs.
Well, that's not sex ed because...
But it also goes through... It also is...
All right, do whatever you come up with.
I will just be approved
from the state to the board.
I will provide you with the materials that they are using. And when I asked the teachers, how will this, if there is a approval from the board, how will this impact your class? And they said a class period. This is not a major component of what they do. It's interwoven in what they currently have. It's just statistics on how to prevent yourself from STIs and unwanted pregnancy.
So what's interesting when you say that is because there's literally a law on this. So it's not like it is a policy I'd like to. The state actually wrote a law on this as to what you can and can't do, how it's supposed to work and whatnot. So to say something that became a law in the state of Michigan that takes like forever to get through, to get passed, to get approved of, is only going to minimally, like, do a little blip into an entire program.
The law goes down to the local level. Your SEEB is going to be the advisory as far as to what extent you want to go. So some local, right, if you give me 1 second, though, the law is very broad. Your local level is going to either make more restrictive or less restrictive and how far you want to go. So in our district, we stopped at abstinence. It's only that the seed now is bringing forward is we'd like to go a step further. That's all.
That's not how the law is applied. The law is applied that you can't teach any of that unless you have a seed present and it operates and it goes through the board. I mean, that is the law. So prior to that,
I don't understand your argument here.
I'm not making an argument. I'm just trying to understand what we're currently doing. And he made some different comments today, and I just wanted the answer to it.
Question. At the end of the day, no matter what we decide, no matter what state decides, still at the end of the day, it's up to the parents, correct? They can say, I don't want my kid in.
Well, first and foremost, it's up to our... either committee, the board, that group right there, to make a recommendation to the board, district.
Thank you.
Right, okay? And what, and off of that, the Board of Education will make their decision. Then it's still like this opt-in letter right here.
Right.
It's the parent's choice at that point. Do they?
Right, because I would never want to take that choice away from them.
Yeah, so it's still good. The parents still have the ultimate say whether or not the child would. We've actually, by going with an opt-in letter, made it so that it's made it so that as everyone that's a parent in this room, you have to say yes, or your child doesn't take part. So,
I want to make sure I understood
that. That out.
The reason I wanted, when you said that, the clarification on it, because I think it does matter in the conversation. Because the way we're presenting this as a gateway to open the conversation, once we as a board approve this, then pretty much the board has given its okay for where it goes from there. Because the way this seems written up, once you have the gateway in of what the approvals, once you have the condom in there, everything else associated with it can then be brought in. And we brought that, that was discussed at one of the other meetings. And so the reason I'm going through all of this is I want everybody to clear and understand there's two ways to look at this. Those that 100% want it, and those like me that 100% don't want it. David 100% wants it, I 100% don't want it. So as much as I'm asking him questions, it's not for me, it's for all of you to understand what is
I think we all understood it. Okay. I don't need you to ask questions for me.
I'm saying this is a big decision for everybody in the board. It's a huge decision. Putting sex into schools where we're not required to do so is a very big deal. I don't think it is anything like. I don't think the community.
I haven't heard from anybody else sitting here. I've heard from you.
Anybody else can say what they want. Carrie talk, Mary talk. No, they can say what they want.
Know, our decision is here to go forward.
Yeah.
We're having a lot of discussion of where we're at today, but really the decision we as a board have is do we want to go forward with what we see as proposed?
We can't
vote. That doesn't change anything of what we're doing today.
Yeah, but we can't vote on that today. So the only thing we can
vote on today is
just discussion.
Yes.
Yeah. But I would also argue that this process that's in place with having the seed above all other processes in a school district is more rigorous at an approval because it can't even, if it couldn't make it out of the seed room, it doesn't even get to the board. So, and the seed has has major requirements as far as who sits on that committee. So this process and or the any kind of teachings is even at a higher level because I actually went through a two double vetting process to get you think about the group and it's here. So, but I think one of the things we tried to also point out to your point is that the opt-in is the key to the whole thing because with the opt-in, you might say no. You might say no. You might say no. No, 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 no. And I, on the other hand, would say, yes, we want our child to have it. It's there for the parents that want their kids to have that opportunity. And if the parents don't, no, opt out. And the best part is, though, if parents don't have it, it's out.
So that's an easy conversation for you because you want it, he wants it. I understand that you guys want it. I just wish it was a level playing field.
I am like the Lorax. I speak for the trees. And I speak for the trees.
I feel like I'm an island over here myself.
No, I understand your perspective. You know, we had a nice chat about what we thought, and I'm representing the SIEB. I would be happy if you would like to take that over. I understand how it's so
you just bring in a recognition from the
SIEB. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like a level playing field. It feels this is what we want, and here's what we want.
Question, maybe. With the two meetings you had, you only had one couple that came in. Did you get any other letters or anything from other parents that what their opinion from the community is?
No, the couple that came in assumed we were already talking about these things. They seemed fine with it. And I don't want to say that it's – I don't know, and I'm being honest right now, I don't know if this is something that our families think about. Like, it was too late in the day when I thought, you know, I'd like to talk to Coach Clark and Mrs. Gates and find out how many opt-outs they have. I think that might be an interesting piece of information to hunt down. We had, I think, we were talking about the MiFi, which at the high school, I think there were maybe 8 at the high school of people that didn't want their kids to take the MiFi. You know, I don't believe this is an issue for where we're thinking to go. I don't think it was an issue for a lot of our families, and that might be completely wrong. But based on the feedback that I got,
they just don't opt in.
So part of what I look at with that is we're an elected board. So we are elected by people out there, thousands and thousands of people vote, right? Everybody.
Well, not that many, but okay.
You got 4,000 or something. No,
okay.
But people vote, okay?
Right. But not even presidential.
If you got 4,000 votes, okay, yeah. Each person voting here got 4,000 votes. Those 4,000 votes were for what that person stood for. And so people tell me, look, you're an elected position. You're not elected for yourself. I'm not sitting here saying, what do I want? You're elected for those people that you spoke to when you campaigned. What did you tell them? What did they ask you? What did they say? Those are who we represent. I know the people that voted for me. No, I would be 100% against teaching sex in schools in any capacity, any way, beyond health class, which is already approved. And so I know those people will support me in my vote. So I think it's a little different than just people sitting here, because we are elected officials and we are representative of the community. So that, to me, changes the story a little bit. I mean, it's not like Andy. I mean, David's paid to do that job. So if David goes and gets Jamie's job tomorrow, you know what I mean? Then David no longer has that job, and it's no longer his thing to do. It's now.
We're so far around the weeds now, I don't know where.
No, it's not. It's just you. We're elected officials. We are elected officials.
Well, that much I agree with.
Okay, yes.
Not one person has called me on my phone and said, oh my God, do not expect that.
I can tell you, I just ran into Meyer and someone the other day, and we were talking about it, and they texted me today about wanting to come to the meeting because it's on the agenda. So it's not like.
Where are they?
So, but that's where. Oh, so when we think about it in this term here, that's why we put in the opt-in side of it, because it's one of those areas where you got people on both sides. And so those that don't. Those that do, because there are some parents in our community, they don't want to touch it, and they can't. And so they'd much rather allow for how far we're even going here. I mean, it's not like we're going far. And again, you're back to, you have the seed that's it to bring it to you guys. And so the opting in side of it allows for each parent to make that decision.
And I would never want to take that away from
them. I don't think sex should be taught in schools at all. I don't.
There's nobody in this room that does not believe that.
Huh?
There's nobody sitting in this room that does not believe that.
Does not believe what?
That you don't think sex should be taught in school.
Right.
Absolutely.
And everybody thinks it's you stand for it.
We are 16 minutes beyond our allocated time for the subject.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes, sir. I saw you down there. You were.
Well, I was enjoying the debate. learned a lot. I guess what we're being asked for is you want to add two new things up to the current curriculum: barrier protection and HPV. Okay. Now the HPV thing, I got a daughter that's a doctor, so she put me on to some information that I started reading. Are we going to teach this about this vaccination for what the general public is finding out? That there's a lot of controversy around Gardasil. There's a lot of it. And the biggest one right now they're finding out is autoimmune diseases. Autoimmune is a hereditary disease. But people taking Gardasil are coming up with autoimmune diseases where they never had any in any of their family members, and they can't figure out why. Okay. I'm trying to be agnostic about this. I really am. But if we decide to teach this, I think it's really important to teach everything that's going on about this, that there is a lot of controversy around Gardasil.
Would you first, like, I agree with you, and it's more awareness,
right,
and not campaigning for folks to get it. But if you have information, love to look at it.
Sure.
Love to talk about it. And, you know.
Well, there was one thing, I guess, because being on the board, I mean, this is your guys' job. People come to us.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one something disturbing that came out about this. And it was one of the teachers told one of the girls, if you don't get this vaccine, you're going to die. That's the word. If it's true or not, I assume it is. I mean, come on, guys. You can't say that.
I would love to know who that teacher was.
I don't know. And I guess, you know, I don't think that I...
It's been addressed.
Has it been addressed?
Yeah. Okay. Good.
So I guess the next
that should be addressed.
Yeah. I think any discussion on vaccines is the discussion should be, it should be between the parent, the student, and their physician. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can state there are vaccines out there, and Gardasil is not the only one. There's only three total that are out there. But all that's got to be a discussion because of their general health to start with. And yes, there is some significant side effects. There's litigation going on in the state of California because of this. I think it is strictly due to the autoimmune diseases.
Similar with the COVID vaccine, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
There's so much coming out on that.
That's why I was asking about this. So if we decide to teach this, are we going to be unbiased and say, well, this is a good thing to do, but there are serious side effects to this. And this, and this would happen.
That wasn't presented
to us. Well, no,
this is presentation.
Well, no, this is what I found out after the fact.
No, I agree.
My daughter, and she sent me in this direction to find this stuff out.
I agree, but I'm just saying they did not present that in their presentation, any of the negative.
Then we got, gosh darn, we got Stacey sitting here. She knows all about this crazy stuff.
I would say, in regards to research, I would love to see it, and I would like to say that we looked. I have not seen anything. I know there's heading litigation out there. I believe it's, I don't want to talk about
this. So, what I'm going to offer up is, David, hopefully just to see coming back together, especially when we're talking and share with the points we made here in the boardroom, but also in our workshop. The other part is with the HPV, get into what we taught. And when I say what we taught is literally, it should be like a little simple script, maybe a two-paragraph thing, especially like what Tom's saying, is that understand that we're sharing this information, but at the end of the day, between you, your doctor, and your parents, you should make a decision.
Isn't that already done in health class, though? HPV
is discussed in
health class. It's an STI. Yeah. So, you've got a lot of information on this before
you can
be back together, okay?
Sure.
Yeah,
then I think we can bring it into another workshop on this. Yeah. This is a very emotional and critical discussion, so I'm going to do it like, yeah, we'll do right now.
Thank you. All right, next item up is a piece of paper in your diagrams to cut your parent loop. I blew it up on the screen to make it a little bit easier for you to see. What we're doing is getting close right now. This is the driveway entrance into where the bus garage. The buses are all at. So this is where a new entrance would go in. It's four lanes wide. That way you can get a lot of cars. Tapering it down to a two, tapering down to a one. Currently, all the parents, they come in here, buses get all jammed up. So you're going to have about 125 cars that can fit in this stretch right there. Once the we get to the time where it's about 5 minutes before dismissal, then the cars from right here go back into their normal line to do the pickup like they currently do. Would be is the current plan right there. Melissa and I haven't talked much further. Like if we'll have a stop down here or a bus in. We had to leave. We're not going to let parents through here because this is our bus lane that goes around, okay? And that's what's most vital is we get those buses in smoothly, right on around. And our goal is that at each elementary that, and I'm just going to use this as an example, I don't know the exact time, but 3:45 is dismissal. Buses are all pulling in here at 3:40, so they're all lined up. And so at 3:45, when that bell rings, the kids can go out. Because right now what's happening is the bus 69 is pulling up here, and the radium's next, or they're just, it's a radium system there, and so it's a staggered dismissal. And so that would make it, though, so we have that these cars getting out of there. We're staggering the time as far as this building on drop-off and releases so that you're not going to have your preschool students and your K-4 students there. But that'll help get everyone off of this road, and it'll keep this open for buses. So
normal gravel, like Raisville. Yeah. The only thing, the biggest thing we have to do here is, this area is, it's low. We're going to have to bring this up a little bit, and then we're going to have to work with the drain commission. We're going to have to run some tile down here to get water down to the ditch.
Will we eventually ever blacktop it?
Potentially, after a couple of years.
Get everything packed down?
Let everything packed down. We'll take a look at it.
I got to watch where I hit.
In Raisville, we'll potentially get back up at some time, too. It's just,
I just
again, that was like a lot like this, where it's just, it's so, it's these kind of cast down.
We're going to have a culvert at there.
Right here?
Yeah.
So.
And no issues with approvals from the drain commission?
Not as yet. We have some people in our, that are going to come alongside us to work. But,
shouldn't be a problem.
Nope.
So, do you anticipate that the cars that are, the capacity of cars that are currently on Auburn Road will be able to fit into there? Because what happens is they go this way and they go this way, and then you can't turn either way.
So by knowing that this building is going to be about 500 kids, knowing the number of kids that ride the buses, that's why we're setting this up to be right around 125, 140 cars to get in here. And then once they really start showing up, you gotta remember too, they're gonna start moving forward. So you're gonna have 30, 40 cars right in here once they start to move. You know, now if all 125 show up 5 minutes before dismissal, we're back to the Raisinville issue.
I'm gonna say, I sit in Raisinville and sit on the road for 15 minutes.
If that's what parents are gonna do, then we can't do anything about
that. So the buses, then these cars will not be let into this lane.
No, they're gonna be stopped right here.
Okay.
And once buses come through, that's part of the thing. So Melissa will have an opportunity next year to shoot a video and literally model that bus coming stop, but bus pass. So it's just like a regular intersection right there.
But you won't have cars mixed in with this bus line.
No.
Correct?
Okay. No. Bus line is over here. These cars will do what they already do, which is come here. It'll really take off a lot of pressure because right now, if you go over this building, and you park yourself right in here late in the afternoon.
Then I
go to the park. One of these cars here can pull out and kind of, you're not getting out.
Yeah.
Okay. So it really, like I said, it mainly opens us up and it'll get everybody off of Albany. So when they're coming out now, turning left or right, it's not a big deal. But they back up out there.
They all park in those spots where you guys put their signs.
Yeah.
They all park there still.
Ordinance is coming.
Yeah, there's like 12 cars.
There's an ordinance coming that'll be that there's no parking on this road. But the biggest challenge you have is you can't get buses in. That's what messes the whole system up is you have all these the parents and it just chokes up the line there. So
when I came for the cooking the contest. I couldn't believe that.
So we'll have, we're targeting, hopefully by that May board meeting right here or the very first one in June, you'll have the amount of money that's going to be charged process to put this in. It's not good. When you start to look at it down the line, it's very comparable to what we've been doing. It just alleviates a whole lot of pressure. And we already know, too, no burial grounds, okay? That was one thing that got brought up. There's burial grounds here. No, don't feel like that. I did have a community member brought that up. Don't help me out.
I take a word on community member saying stuff.
So I said it because I believed it since I was 12 years old.
I went
to school there, and that's what they told us, that there was a burial ground.
Did they make a movie about that?
Poltergeist.
So these kids
are going to be
in
So our next item that we wanted to go over was the Navarre Field lighting discussion. So in your packet, we ran through this one really fast last time. So Navarre Field annually costs us approximately $50,000 to $60,000. Okay. And you can see the utilities, the gas, lawn care,
custodial, field lining, everything we do to that field. As I said, it's roughly about $50,000 to $60,000 price tag. We're just showing this to you because we want you to understand and help us when it comes time to do anything with the lights. When I say the lights, it's the bulbs up inside them. So the bulbs burn out, and we have to do something about that, or we don't. Now, SMCC, because of the style of football they run, if it can be pitch black out there, the better, because it's going to help their game. but... It's a style of football. It's all about hide the ball. Okay? So, the things that we have to us understand is, and I asked Dave, were you getting kind of numbers?
To their record, the only time we possibly changed the bulbs is when we had the Osprey and they had to move it. They might have did it at that time, but we have no record of swapping bulbs out before.
Okay.
At least in the last 10 years that they could find.
Yep. So from our two electricians. That's a good point. The bulbs are now approaching at least 10 years old. Mm-hmm. So at some point they're going to start to burn out. And our choice is, do we go and rent the lift to go buy the bulbs to put them up there? And you can see, okay, that's a cost on to what we do.
But you'd replace every bulb.
Well, that becomes the question is, how far do you want us to go in spending money for a facility that we don't use?
No. What I'm saying is, if you're going to go right
to truck,
I would replace every bulb there if I had a truck there.
Right.
I guess it depends on what the cost
is. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know.
$100, $110
probably. Yeah. I think
replace bulbs to back charge.
So
I say we don't replace them at all, but that's just me.
Well, there is, but that's that idea for where the bar field could be down the road. That's even 3-5 years. But right now, I want to be able to talk to the SMCC and be able to say, listen, if the bulbs can start burning out, understand Monroe Poly School is going to not do anything with that. Or we could rent the truck and charge you. Which do you want it to be?
Yeah. We have any bulbs
currently? Would they be able to fix them?
No.
They would just be without lights.
They would be without lights. They would.
That hence your comment.
Either
right?
A, we pay for it, or B, we go to them and they have to pay for it, or they say no, we're going to just let it get dark and then we're going to play games on Saturday.
Would they really do that?
I talked to Joe.
It's not the money.
I talked to Joe this afternoon. I says, you know, what are the plans out of the Boeing Mission for Central's new field? And he said 2 years minimum before
they get money.
So
and what's that? What's that?
They have no problem with the state of the
field.
Out of the Corona project.
Out with the project. Out
of the world.
Yeah.
So.
And that's 2 years out.
He said minimum of 2 years.
Which is why your plan is 3-5 years.
Well, no, ours for that property right there, if we could do, because we're going to talk about like the property sale for the Pleasants Road, just that stretch. But if their project's moving along faster, then you can come to you guys sooner.
So they are related, the two?
They are, only in the fact that I want to hear any kind of where you guys stand on it. And by the way, if I don't hear anything, it's all good. I want to be able to talk to SMCC and say, listen, if the lights, if bulbs start burning out, understand Monroe Public Schools is not changing a light bulb. Now, if you want to pay for us to replace light bulbs on these light bulbs, we will, because we're already, last year, for example, SMCC had a great year, so almost $9,000 that they paid us, and we paid out $50,000, $60,000. So, that property that for how we don't even use it.
So anymore. We so it costs $50,000 to $60,000 to maintain the property for our income.
Yeah. And that's the thing is our and so it really comes
and
to
then
it.
We would the light bulbs would be on top of that.
That's the whole point. Okay. Is that and I'm just talking about the light bulbs, not no new poles, just change out a light bulb, one dead one out, one ruin it.
You know, that was the my next question is what condition are those light bulbs in?
Well, it sounds like they haven't been touched in 10 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm pretty confident that every pole is all up here. So,
yeah,
that's So.
Yeah, that's my question. How many bulbs are actually out now?
Dave said, you said none, right? All the bulbs are lit.
And we check with both electricians to see if the history, if it was like 4 years ago or 5 years. Okay. The only thing they said is when MT was out there, they might have done maintenance because they were up there and had a reason to be up there to knock it out. Like you're saying, Larry, if we're already up there, let's get them
right,
swapped out. Mm-hmm. So we just didn't have that information because that was kind of what DT was doing.
What did you get out of that? That all the bulbs are operating currently?
Right now, yes.
Okay.
There's no bulbs burning.
So this is a just in case.
This is.
And you said they haven't been burnt out in like 4 to 5 years.
So we haven't any record of having to change any.
And,
now, I would want to go over there, turn them on, to make sure. Because who knows after winter if something happens.
You're not going to have him sitting
there. Not yet. Yeah,
no. You won't ever. But I just want to hear from your voices as far as I talk to SMCC and say, listen, if light bulbs go out, you all are going to have to pay for it.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's where I stand.
Yes.
That we can't.
Because we don't use it any time for night, right?
No.
Okay, then we ain't going to post the bulbs.
Does even the junior high, do they
go to high school?
They go to high school.
They go to high school now. Okay.
Where the good fields are.
Yeah. And a lot of times they get started too.
That's the only people that use that field. Timberwolves don't use it anymore.
No, they're gone.
It's like a reunification site for emergency.
Yeah, we were actually doing that. For that.
Cool, it's dark.
Future.
It's going to be early in the morning and the winter.
But correct me if I'm wrong, long term, we don't want nothing to do with the bar field anymore.
Hopefully, long term, we get out of property business in general.
Get out of
the property business.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Because you also have a boiler that you have to maintain, too, don't you?
Yeah, all the plumbing.
I don't disagree.
So you got to open it up in this,
the cost
the spring.
Yep, then boilers go down.
So property is a good thing.
The age of that boiler is going to be pretty old over there, too.
So the other item for you is this. Tomorrow night on your agenda, you'll see Dave Graves with Habitat. He's really come a long ways. So he actually has a formal drawing up here, okay? Yeah. So just a little bit of this is what it'll look like. You have two houses, so forth, coming in here. He had to, because of the power lines,
which are where in that drawing?
So this is La Pleasance Road.
Okay.
Right here is the current Habitat store.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So this is our, there's a house that sits right there. Then you have a store. So that's our stretch. Okay. Okay.
That's where the power lines are.
And the power lines are right here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Down there.
So because of the distance of the power lines, he talked to Tom and I this morning and said, I needed some more area right here. So, it still puts us quite a ways away from the football field. It all sits over in this spot, okay? So it's about 3 acres, approximately $80,000. And for SMCC for this fall, no problem because they're not going to, they can still park here. It won't be until sometime in 26 when that project will actually get going there. So
they're not beginning that project till about 26.
Sometimes, yeah. He felt like by the time...
It is halfway to almost...
It is. That's exactly it. So he's his major donor in June. So he wants to get it purchased. But he's come a long ways with the city and everything like that. What we've done is we put it on the agenda for tomorrow night as information only because there's no requirement for us to have to do a public posting. There's no requirement for us to go out and seek other bids. None of that. What we did is we put it into our board session Monday underneath new business just as information. So then that way everybody can hear about it because people come live stream in, get it that way. In May, though, you will have a formal letter purchase agreement that's already been constructed by our attorney, and that will be in front of you, though, to approve the sale of this property.
One question. Once they take over the property, we're done mowing it, we're done doing anything with it, correct?
As soon as that 3 acres, the moment that they sign it, and we go to the title agent, sign, we're done.
Okay. That's what I wanted to make sure.
But you also have to mow all that.
We still mow everything else.
Right.
Yeah. All small part.
But that 3 acres is out of our area.
That's what I wanted to make
sure. And the most funny, interesting thing, though, is the Dust Bowl. It's
the Dust Bowl.
Yeah, right. So that's
Because I'm not bothered.
No. Well, just we don't. It was hard ground. We just never put any love into it. That's all put over there. So that's why you see on the agenda for tomorrow. It's just surely information. So if people ask you, yeah, we have this great opportunity right here on the Pleasants Room to sell something that's going to have 8 houses put into it to have it happen.
Okay? The great thing is, I don't know if everybody's aware, the city is what they call the Pleasants Corridor Project. They're going to change the connection of Jones Avenue into La Pleasance. They're going to have a bike path that goes all the way out to the pot shop.
The pot shop, right.
And then they're going to put sidewalks on Jones all the way
to the program.
Now I ride my bike. No,
they're trying to make it a walkable area.
Yeah.
So this fits in well with that whole project. Okay.
So they're actually changing that intersection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I was going to ask.
Yep.
So this triangle piece that's on, yeah, the southern.
Yeah.
Do we know what is that just going to be like big green space? Do we know what that's going to be turned into?
So because it is just green space.
Okay.
Yep. And then he actually has he's going to put a sidewalk
because
in.
Yeah.
No, but it has.
Well, you can't put any houses there because of the power line.
Right, but there will be a sidewalk over here in Jones Ave.
Okay.
So
could the people that live in those places right there use that grass?
Yeah, that's
okay. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
He said that he wants to put like green gardens.
Yes, that's where my brain was going.
Yeah.
Is it just going to sit there green and then turn into,
or
is it
going to
be something intentional?
For what he's really thinking about, I know I don't have
it
right here.
Love it.
If you think about what he wants to do with the whole piece of property down the road, that's not going to happen. I mean, he wants to develop all those Jones Ave and then the side street and put more houses up on that. So I think that's going to really, that property will look a lot different in about 8 years.
So they want everything eventually.
Yeah. Eventually, if it works out. If this concept works really well, then yeah, he can advance it.
That's why I was asking what our long-term thinking is in the bar field, and it's like,
houses.
Why spend any money?
Yeah,
we don't use it. We don't want it.
Yeah.
Somebody else.
Looks like it's going to be houses.
Well, yeah. but that was the thing. You know,
nothing wrong with that.
No,
it's
actually great because when we talked to the city before, they're looking at going, you can't put a business in there, you know, like anything industrial, because you have a big block underneath. And so the housing, and so it was just a great idea that he had, especially with Thor and all the businesses over here. And it's really not that far of a walk downtown either.
Right.
It's a beautiful concept. And especially what I love most about those showing how the people that own the house, how they have a tenant and they have continual income coming in. But I wanted you to understand why you see it on the agenda for tomorrow. It's just straight up information. The purchase agreement will be in your hands as soon as possible.
So should we ask the questions so you have all the answers
tomorrow night?
Yeah, I'm going to do a real brief presentation on this right here. I'll use some of his slides tomorrow night with it so people can see and have an understanding.
Maybe some of the questions that we asked tonight maybe
So another question that came up was around the wireless door access pilot. So I asked Dave, Mr. Payne, to talk about that for a moment.
Sure. So I'll kind of go over real quick the history to get everyone up to speed on our district security and access control. Probably about, let's just call it 2 years, give or take, we started gradual. We started doing access control so you could use your badge to get into a building. And we did major entrances first. Then I want to say Dr. Everly, we applied for a grant, and we were able to do a majority of the external doors that we used through a grant through Michigan. There was some kind of grant that really got most of the external doors. And since then, we've added a few during the bond work where the secure entrances come in. Instead of having a main door, now there might be 3 or 4. But what we learned was is as we started to grow, a perfect example would be Custer 1. That office complex had multiple doors. So what we wanted to do, and we didn't have time last year due to the bond work, is to come up with an alternative solution so we could still have access control on interior doors, but not at the cost of what we were currently doing. The doors that we do now, there's power hardwired to the door. So a newer door during bond construction, it's already got the pathways there. It's set up for it. You have to have a controller box about this big. It can handle 1 to 3 doors, and depending on there you put it, you can expand. But we, like I said, we're usually doing just entrance doors or exterior doors. But with Waterloo and with taking over the keys for operations, we're looking at trying to enhance the district and do something that's at a cheaper cost, but allow staff members to use their badge to get into the room. So that's what you've seen on the board briefs, was to come up with a solution. Since we were going to be taking the doors down and work at Waterloo, this would be a good time to pilot that solution at Waterloo. And I think Mr. Plitzy also wants to do it in the Commons, to try it in a couple doors there to see how it works. The nice thing about this is everything's contained in the door handle, the hardware, and it can be done wireless. You don't have to hardwire power. So a lot of the older doors that you see, like Waterloo or some of the buildings, this actually is a good solution. It also gives us a chance to recore the doors. As for the last 50 years, these keys have been used, lost, left. People don't return them. That brings up its own side of safety and security as well. So this will allow us to continue the access control when teachers leave. If somebody becomes a sub, we can give them access much quicker than having them come in, sign out a key, give them a key, make sure they get it back, give the offices a lot of keys, which those don't always get returned. So it's a much cleaner way of doing things. And the price point, just to give you a perspective, the exterior door is roughly around $3,000. When we started, it was about $2,000. So in the last 10 years, it's creeped up cost-wise. These doors, if we do the internal, the vendor we're looking at, and we're actually going to wait till we go to MSBO just in case something better comes up. The ISD just got a RFP. We want to see what they picked and before we move forward with Waterloo. Because it's not like there's no door handles now where we have to get this done by a certain time, but it's a good time to do it. And it's a small building to pilot this. So to do these doors, you're probably looking at closer to $800 to $900 a door compared to the $3,000.
Is this similar to like what hotels use? Pretty much exactly. What
there's two variances. And so one variance would be is it's just a door handle. There's no wireless. When you swipe your card, it updates. So in that chip, RFID chip, it contains all the changes. So the only way to update that door is to have someone use it. The other option is to put little wireless access points that will talk to it all the time. So that door is always updated with the latest and greatest. And that's probably the recommendation we go with. That would go in line with ACAP's recommendation of if we had to go into lockdown. That's the other thing. If a teacher forgets to lock their door, now if we go into lockdown, it does it automatically. So they don't have to remember to do it. That would be another benefit of that.
Is this interact with the night lock system that we have?
The night lock would be a specific physical thing you would have to do.
Yeah.
So one of the I appreciate Dave bringing this up and then the questions with it too, because when you go through and rekey a building, okay, and or you have to reseller, that's an expensive process.
That's
so. So what he's trying to do is they have a conference coming up next week where we'll get more information there, but it's about the kind of technology it makes so we don't have that kind of a cost. The concern.
The core is the king, and every time you have to give somebody a key, that if you take that 5-10 minutes here and there, you add that up over a year, it's a lot.
Ballpark, how much you talk for all the ones in school?
So you're probably looking, I would say, between $15,000 and $20,000, depending. It depends on how many doors we go with. If obviously you have 14 classrooms you want to do, and then there's some ancillary offices. With the bond work, that's included now. So those doors would already be done. It's what we're looking at is a system that would tie in with what we already use. So it would be we wouldn't have to have multiple systems. Their badges would work. Student badges would work at some point if we ever did that.
I thought all that bond money was already allocated.
But my point is, since we're redoing the office, those office doors are included with the bond work. We wouldn't have to pay for that extra.
That wasn't part of the plan when the bond work was done.
When the offices got built, because the office is part of the bond bill, so you got to put doors on it.
So this could be the doors you put
just in. The office.
I'm saying
just
that was already checked off the list, so we went up
just the area that the bond is doing.
I try to pay attention.
Just the area that bond is doing.
So this system we have on campus, super easy to use. And then something that you mentioned briefly, but I think it warrants repeating. When people have keys, like key entry, typical keys, and they leave and they don't turn them in, that is a huge safety risk. Because if they drop the key and somebody else picks it up, and then they now have access to your room, to your building, to whatever, that's a scary situation. And the system that they're talking about is a beautiful system because access can be revoked in a second. And it can also be provided from anywhere to anyone instantly. So it's a wonderful thing for, like, subs, as you said, but also, like, if I have to host an event at Monroe High on whatever date, when you see me fill out the building use form, boop-a-doop, there could be like a little checkbox. I'm going to need access to Monroe High on this day, and that it automatically gets loaded into my ID. So I don't have to worry about contacting security officers or whoever my music teacher friend is, that I can just know that my key fob is going to be able to get me to wherever I need to go.
Looking at how the keys were, and I'm not going to say somebody did something wrong, but just looking at how keys were kept. If I was my house, I would pay for the district to be rekeyed. I'm just going to be honest with you. So our options are change how we do it moving forward and hopefully keep eliminating that need for those cores to be swapped out. And to try to keep the cost low and gradually use our security budget or maybe a grant moving forward to help build on it. But we need one system to start testing on and to integrate so we can start building off it. And that's why we chose Waterloo, because it was small enough and it was a good place to do it where it wasn't, we didn't have to pick a certain area of a building, just do the whole building.
So, I know I don't know who else did, but I asked about this for a couple of reasons. One is the reason, because I wasn't aware of that. The other thing is when we were looking at the amount of money that we're spending on security and we're watching those dollars skyrocket and skyrocket, my understanding is, like, we need safety. And they have come in, and they said, door locks are the way to go. Those, you push it down.
Those are already in before ACAP and I got
ACAP. I know that. Okay. I'm trying to
say. You're talking about the night locks, right?
Night locks, yes. I'm just trying. So that was the safety feature that we decided in the event of a lockdown, any students in the classroom, that is the way that it goes. And that's why we purchased those. I'm trying to understand why classroom doors need to be locked and only accessed by a teacher or someone, because the building is secure. You got all of these things secure. If it goes into lockdown, we have the night lock system. So why do the classroom doors need to be locked?
They have to be locked. That's our directive. Every classroom during instruction has to be shut and locked.
When did that start?
Years.
When I was 16 years ago. Yeah.
No, I'm being dead serious.
Yeah,
y'all have to remember, I went from 2005 until, a few years ago. So I do know a lot of things happened and a lot of things changed. So when this came up, that was my first thought. Why are they locked?
And what Mary said is,
I think there's a safety hazard because if the teacher falls, the kids can't get out.
You can always get out. You just can't get in.
Yeah, you can't lock somebody in the room.
Thank you. If it's a key that locks me, it's locked.
Nobody
can
get in.
We're not out here, but you on the inside can always open the door.
Okay. You see, I'm just catching up because I never talked about this before.
This is a same thing we're already doing, exact same. The only difference is the amount, what you need for power and cabling is different because we're using a wire solution, which you wouldn't want to do on a door that has a breaker bar or handicap you wouldn't want to do this type of solution for your exterior doors, but for a single door, it's the perfect solution.
So when we talk about putting this district-wide, because a pilot is to install everywhere, and that was what my understanding was, that it was to be installed everywhere once the pilot got approved.
Well, we'd
so
like
you
to.
Can build out on it.
If we have the money.
That's what you said. So you're putting in the foundation right now so it can be built on. So you had to calculate the cost on a total district-wide installation of this. What is it? So we're going to put a plan in place that's going to build the foundation for all the us, the buildings, but we haven't
so
decided
the
cost.
Well, no, we've decided the cost. Here's the problem. It wouldn't be, I would have say, let's spend, you know, $442,000 for every door, because you got doors that aren't, I would, my recommendation would be do your classrooms first.
So, ballpark.
Well, yeah,
I mean,
three.
I'm looking at, you know, it sounds like we're like, okay, it's only $50,000 to $60,000. But in reality, it's hundreds of thousands.
You have 300. You have to, let's call it 300 and probably 15 classroom, yeah. And then you have another 20, if you, because you can't do things like on a gym door. It'd have to be different. But let's say the standard classroom. You have probably, when it's all said and done, between $200,000 and $350,000, depending. But here's the thing: if I did it all today, is one number. But if you do it over 5 years, that's a different number as well. That's why you do the grants. And you do it as you can afford it. Security can never stop. I'm just going to be honest with you.
I understand that.
And it has to be done in layers. So,
but at the same time, we know where the fund dollars are going. We have to be more specific about what we're utilizing our money for. And again, I'm not suggesting that we don't do it. I just want to look realistic. You know, everything on our table is $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. And there isn't an endless supply of money.
So the difference, what you have to think about is this. Putting in a new core with regular traditional key, okay, the cost of that.
I don't know what that costs.
That's one of the things that they would say.
So you, it's not just that, you know, it's a 20, is a 50, depending on what core you use and what options you have, but also it takes a maintenance personnel to go out and do it. You have to cut the keys. You have to label the keys.
Just a ballpark. I mean,
to do what?
You
what's your question?
So
what's
a new core for a door?
$252,000.
It's
thank you.
$315.
Thank
yeah.
you. At $800 a door, then
$800 a door.
Yes. Thank you.
That's what you would have in.
If we did them all right now.
Yeah. So that's what I'm just looking at, because once we start it, we do know that we basically have said we're going to continue the project. So everybody's aware if this is something that the board wants to do. That is thank you, Larry. That was
I think when you. Before the horse, we're going to see how it works.
Right.
Because
that's why,
technology is constantly changing.
Yep.
In 2 years, something newer may come that's
and
less
the prices
expensive.
Could go down.
Yeah.
Couldn't your eye, too.
So, something, so as an example, on campus, we technically have two different systems that use the same technology. We have some that you have to swipe like an old-fashioned credit card swiper. Mm-hmm. But then we also have the new fancy ones where you just go, boop, and you just, in you go. So, like, that could be the difference in the future. It might be, like, a touch, but it could also turn into something else in the future where it's just proximity, where you can have it in your pocket and you walk through the door. So, who knows, but,
So, mine. Mine's a little... gets me into my commercial office space and then into my office space.
And that's what you're projecting to use?
And doing nothing's a cost.
You can do, there's little cards.
We use their proximity, so it would be the same.
Their ID, their school ID.
Like our school badge.
Yes. Same thing.
So the idea is starting out with Waterloo, and we can get you the cost of what if we had to re-core the doors at Waterloo. You know, put in its
well, I think we've already determined that that there is a significant reason to use this and not do that.
Right.
That was
kind of the trade-off. It was like, okay, you can stay the one way or go the other direction there. So you have an idea, okay, what's the cost? I completely agree with Dave, what he's saying, though, is, in all honesty, you could start with Waterloo, and you may sit there for another 10 years before you move into another building. Because the financials may not be there.
Well, that's what I'm thinking. Grants are going to be drying up. Grants are not going to be building out. They're going to be drying up more than they're building out. So if you're looking at doing this solely with grants, That's one thing. If you're looking at using general fund, that's
but I don't think you can look at it black and white like that. It really, if we do water as a pilot, we might say, you know what? Athletics is really hard to give out keys and there's a lot of changes. Why don't we do the athletic areas? Or why don't we do these general common use areas? Because again, with security, what Mary said is so true. You loop the key, somebody gets it, or you, I'm a sub, I don't have a key, I'm just going to leave my door open. That's where bad things happen. And that's what happened in Texas. Printer went bad. Teacher said, I'll just leave my door open for you. And what door did they go in? So I don't want to always think worst case scenario, but that's the way my brain works. But I do think we look at it. Our goal would be every door if we could afford it. But in the short term, let's go where the best bang for the buck will get us, where the most need is. And that's all I was recommending.
So once we have identified that there's a problem now with the keys, because you said the key situation's a problem right now. We don't know who has them. We don't know where they've been, and we don't know what. So if this is the pilot, what are we doing now that we've identified a problem? Because whenever you identify a problem, you have to address it.
So I'll give you
I'm just following
with yeah, no, that's an easy peasy. That, what he described like in the athletic area, has been a problem
for a long time.
No, schools. He said in general.
No, we have a plan. That's not an uncommon problem in schools.
So we've
you
already.
See my thing?
We've already.
You can't tell when there's an issue with safety with kids and then go, well, we might.
But so what we've done is we've inventoried all keys. And from now on, when somebody gets a key, it's put into Power School and they have to sign for it. During the onboarding process, working with HR, nobody gets out, starts a job without going through technology. And no one ends their job without going through technology. So
you've kind of solved the key problem.
We've solved it moving forward, but it doesn't solve the past.
It doesn't tell you who has a key still out there.
Yeah.
Okay. Our saving grace is this, that to get into our buildings, you either have to A, get buzzed in, or B, have a badge. Okay. Now, if a person can get into the building, you know, after hours, and they were here a long time ago, they have a key, well, they can go anywhere.
We have
I don't want to make this a safety issue.
Well,
it's more about looking at, we have two choices. We can either keep using, when we have to record doors, we can use the old style key, or we can go to the badge system. This is really where it sits, because we're going to have to record doors at some point in time. So as we do that, do we continue to re-put our old key in, or do we start to change out? And so let's not make this a safety thing, let's just make it, what's an economic, what's a forward-thinking approach?
We're looking at salt.
Yeah.
And then the ISD one with a different company. Possibly they're just receiving the bids. That's why we want to.
There's a list of.
We haven't committed yet.
Yeah.
I think if technology goes down, then we got more problems than that.
I get a vacation.
So. So the last item on your agenda for tonight was the enhancement millage. And so Dave Payne, being an older person here. And part of the system, no, he's been a part of the system. So you have a document in front of you that shows the technology millage from the first year, 1997, through taxes collected in 24. Okay, the taxes for this are collected in December. Of how much money the enhancement millage has generated in Monroe County. And so if you look at the bottom far right hand corner, $153 million has been generated in Monroe County through the enhancement millage for technology. Okay, and you can go down and look underneath each one for each school and what each school has had. The technology millage is a 5-year millage. And so it's in, right now it's in its fifth renewal. Spring of 26 is when it would come back up for another for that sixth renewal. How a countywide millage works though is this. It is, each district has to put a request into the ISD to put it on the ballot. Okay. And so next for fall, January, sometime right in there, each district will have a resolution, either vote up or vote down, and be put on the ballot for the county. At that point in time, I'm just going to go on a limb and says, I guess. If the majority of the district said yes, then it goes on the ballot. Okay.
And so then in May of 26, it gets voted on. At the last one, it was a 3-to-1 ratio of pass. Okay, so each school has their number of yes votes they're expected to go out and get. And Don Spencer, who was ISD Super for years, he helps chair this thing. So he has all of the data, brings it all out, and does his thing with it there. When the technology millage was put together, it was really put together to put technology and or infrastructure into buildings in across the county. Districts were using it in that format, along with you could use it for some salaries and benefits in technology, okay? And so each district operates it a little differently. I want to give you an opportunity to share how Monroe's done, because I mean, you've been in that world.
So when I first started, we had, they were called technology TMSs, technology media specialists. And each school had one, and they would, their role was to teach technology and to coach other teachers to help with the technology integration. And we also had a technology consultant and probably, well, one tech person and two tech people, basically. I was one of them. And since then, it was pretty much the district had a, almost like a tech budget and the tech millage budget. And it was really that millage money was supposed to go to either support staff to help curriculum, support the curriculum, support the technology. So for instance, if you were going to buy a phone system, you would put 80% tech millage because it was going in the classroom, but the stuff that went in offices or non-curriculum areas, it would come out of a different budget. Then probably, I want to say in 2000, when we had some cuts, they took away the district tech, and it was pretty much fully under the tech millage. But then in the last 5 years, we started bringing that back because there was no way the tech millage could support it. And then when they changed the rule as far as the ISD and Triumph getting some of the tech millage, if you look on ours, it was 1.6 and then it went to 1.5 because some of that money went to help. Everybody had to divvy that back up. So for our budget, probably I always try to stay under 50%, but it's hard as far as salaries. And then the rest of it went to yearly renewals, software that the schools would use, and then a refresh. So probably next year you'll see us come to the board for new computers in the classroom, smart board, stuff that really sits in the classroom that the teachers utilize. And then we usually do like a 3, 4, 5-year lease to get us through to the next millage. So the core network, the core classroom equipment is good for 5 years. We don't like to usually do that. You'll notice next year we'll probably have a plan ready, and then if the millage gets voted on, then we go forward. So we wouldn't want to put a district in a position where we lost the millage but have this 3-year lease payment. So we try to time it with the renewal. But really, it's always been to support technology needs, support staff. But you'll notice with the 24/7, Cassie always uses other funding, 31A, some other things to help subsidize that because there just isn't enough money to do everything out of that $1.5 million.
So it's a per pupil allocation. If you look at the two boxes up there, you can see in 97, we had 24,446 kids in the county. And this past year, 19,480, so almost 5,000 less students. And so it's per pupil allocation. And so that's how it gets divvied out there. So it has been, for this county, I mean, there were a lot of counties all around that were pretty jealous of what Monroe County had for a lot of years. There's other counties now that have been passing different enhancement millages. But for this county, speaking of, you know, being in Hillsdale and Lenawee counties, it really way, way out there with connectivity. So we just wanted to share this with you and then answer any questions you might have about how any other things might be on this history of the tech user. And we also want to share what they know about it.
Well, I thank you for the history because, and the only good reason I asked the question was because on there it said salary for each benefit, and I don't remember how few $100,000. So my thought was, okay, if the millage didn't pass, how are we going to absorb that amount of staff, and I didn't understand the fringe benefits. Like, that was a very high number, and I wasn't sure if that was fringe benefits from staffing.
Yes.
Or it was
no, the fringe benefits goes right along with the salaries.
Okay.
So,
it's what, 300?
So all direct employees, yeah, I remember they got the state pension, Social Security,
okay.
And then you got your insurances in there.
How
so
many employees is that?
There,
that was my main question.
With there's 1, 2, 3
under the millage.
There's probably, I want to say there's 6 people that would be under, that you would call MPS employees, and the rest would be edu staff that would not get fringes. They would just be salaries.
So in this staffing that we're talking about on this, that's 6 people that are being paid through the millage.
Well, the others are being paid through the millage as well. But for instance, I'm in charge of the mail run. That isn't charged to the tech millage. Print shop staff aren't charged to the tech millage. So
they are not. So who? How many?
Give you a breakdown. It would be.
That was my question. Was just basic.
So you want to know how many staff members are getting charged?
So my question was, how many staff are included in this? Because the second part of it was, if we didn't have the millage, which now sounds like that would never happen. But I didn't know that at the time, what would be the number of staff that we would need to absorb, or we'd be at risk of losing?
We couldn't absorb all.
That's what I'm asking.
No, we couldn't absorb all.
Yeah.
No, if tech millage, and that's been the perk of Monroe County, if the tech millage was voted down, what Monroe and many other districts have, you would lose staff because you couldn't afford to keep them, and then you're going to figure out mechanisms on how you can continue do you continue to do a one-to-one program? Not, and what are you rolling into the buildings? And so it would change drastically.
So that was my thought when I saw it, and now you said it would be spring of 26. That literally is a year from now. And people are struggling now paying their bills. So to me, although it's been all those years, there could be a risk that it wouldn't get passed.
So...
I mean, people don't have money.
No, but we're not going to go out and say, okay, well, hey, just so you know, next in May 26th, we're going out to election. If it fails, you're going to be out of a job.
No. I'm just asking based on that because I'm just trying to understand, is there a plan?
Well, there is a plan. The one plan is that's why we go for renewal. So if it fails, you have another year. And then you also have a year to plan for your tech. And so you might... Effectively giving a student a computer every 4 or 5 years makes sense. But you might not be able to do it every 4 or 5 years if you don't have the tech millage. You have to do what you have to do and what's best for the kids.
Everything's technology now. Yeah. Like, so this is a big deal.
That's why parents usually vote for it, because they understand that.
It's a county-wide village, too.
Yeah.
It's not specifically our district.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just talking about economics.
Yeah, so if Bedford votes overwhelmingly, it may compensate if we vote.
But it's the same kind of, it's the exact same conversations that we already have in regards to the funding mechanism from the state of Michigan. Because if right now $400 a student increase is really, that's really what you need to see. And we start, that number is not going to hold, so it's going to go down. We're going to have to start making other decisions because the budget won't support. Just like if the millage failed, well, all right, time to go, we're going to have to figure out what to do next.
Yeah,
and so.
And I just didn't know anything about it. So thank you for answering my questions. The other thing that you mentioned, like, I saw it was in board briefs. Was there a conversation in board briefs, information about a Chromebook exchange for onto the new tech, what was it, Microsoft?
We were looking at the option of we're looking at the option either this year or next year of switching kids at the high school from a Chromebook to a Windows device, if we can get the price point down, just to give them a better sense of what it'd be like moving to college.
So when would their 5 years or 4 years be up on their that technology?
So right now,
you said it lasts about that long.
So right now, what we do is currently the high school gets a new device in 10th grade. We're going to change that and move that to 9th grade. We're going to adjust it with the elementary redesign. We're going to, now that the students we'll have carts in the classrooms. We'll do 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and then 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th. So it'll be every year, if the money stays good, we'd like to get every incoming 5th grader a device and every incoming 9th grader a device.
Chromebook to...
Well, whatever it is, whether it's a Chromebook, an iPad, or a...
Okay. I just thought it said the switch from Chromebook to Microsoft, and because we're talking about technology and we're talking about that.
Yes.
That's why I'm bringing it up. I wasn't sure what that meant.
It just meant instead of giving a freshman a Chromebook, we'd give him a Windows device, like a laptop, you would call a laptop.
iPad.
Or an iPad. We're looking at all three, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. What's that? They call it the Air or something? What's the iPad?
The Mac. Well.
iPad.
No, yeah. it's like a laptop.
Oh.
It's really trying to figure out what's the technology kids need to be walking out of high school, be able to go to college or into careers. And be,
there's a very
it's funny because the work industry is all.
I can't get your Mac.
No. Industries. Like, U of M is, in most campus spaces at U of M, it's not Apple.
What is it?
It is basically these monster machines that are built by companies I've never heard of.
And that's what they run their technology off of?
They are massive things that, not massive size, like the screens are huge, but like the capacity that these pieces of tech have are beyond anything that I can comprehend. So, yeah.
Is that part of the Cisco network?
It's wild.
They have a lot more, like if you're doing more designs, I'll be at my book, my niece and nephew both go to U of M, and one has a Mac and one has a PC, so they just pick what they want. But I know when my kids went to school, depending on the program, if this tells you if it's a PC or Mac, you just, giving our kids choice or something different isn't a bad thing. It's just the price point for a laptop before to get a decent one was north of $500. Well, a Chromebook, they're starting to get closer to $300, and then Google raised their licensing to $40 or $38. So now you get closer. So now you can start looking at an iPad or a laptop as a comparable device. Well, and the college is no longer going to support Chromebooks. That's another problem we have. Their wireless network, they're not going to support them. So
well, the takeaway that Dave was sharing, though, about that price point, that's what he's really watching. He's working with vendors to really make sure we get the most we possibly can of every single penny of our tech.
That's going to be all of them.
Well, and you also have to look at what you get for a return. Mm-hmm. You know, so like Apple gives you $75 for a used iPad. You get maybe $10 or $20 for a Chromebook, and that's probably one that wasn't used. Mm-hmm. So you start to look at, and what does it cost to fix them? You know, the biggest thing I'm looking at is battery life. Because if a Chromebook after 2 years only lasts 2 hours, it's terrible for a teacher to try to teach when if you didn't bring it fully charged. So there's a lot of things.
Do we not use books at all anymore? That's my question.
Oh, yeah, we have books.
I'm sorry, I'm not part of that thing, but I got a grandson in high school. He had to write an essay, and of course it was all entered online. Several weeks later, he got his grade, which wasn't too great, and that's it. He gets a grade. You don't get a little red mark. You don't get any comments about what could you do to improve your writing skills. And I just don't see the point. Maybe that's not quite right terminology, but I don't think you're getting the same experience as old-timers had. Communicate between your teachers and your kids. Everything's computerized. And everything's battery-operated. I thought we were supposed to be going green and everything's plugged in.
Well, we don't have enough batteries, so we better keep some books because they're not going to last all day.
Yeah.
I can only get you part of the day.
Right. Yep. So there we go. So that's all I have for today, sir.
Well, first public commentary.
Is there any for this? Nope, I don't have any.
I guess you would.
Yeah, I had, the redistricting lines came out, and I'm going to be able to take a look at those. But there were some pretty dramatic changes, and I mentioned to Andy, and in particular, my neighborhood and the entire development was always raising those schools. I was one of those people that I bought my first house and built my second house to be in Ravenlow School for a resale value once my kids are out of school. My kids are out of the elementary school, then So for resale value, because when people research the schools, my development, and I can only talk about mine because I don't know where everybody else is, it is now an Arborwood school. So when people look up what school district their kids are going to go in, they go from one that was Raisinville to Arborwood, and that affects your reselling of your home. So I talked to the township supervisor, and I asked him if he had discussion on these redistricting lines and how did the township feel about it. And he's like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Why would the township have a conversation with us about it?
Because I live in Frenchtown Township. Yeah. So when Monroe Public Schools does something, it affects the Frenchtown Township because I live in the township. Yeah. And so I went to my township supervisor, who is my township supervisor, and said, hey, are you aware that there are homes? And he's like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I said, well, there are areas in your thing that now changes because of the change in the school system. So I would like to have a discussion about that and anybody else that falls in that category, because I think there should be some inclusion, because you're really affecting homeowners in some ways.
So first and foremost, it's Monroe Public Schools. So when we talk about terminology, we have to keep it there. It's Monroe Public Schools. You're talking about an intra-district line for an elementary building. Mm-hmm. And those intra-district lines all shifted. For example, what schools got closed and torn down in our district?
Aiken Christian, CSMJ.
Aiken Christian, always up, right? Yeah. So those areas that were part of those buildings became part of someone else.
So this wasn't part, closed down.
No, I'm giving you history. Is that Monroe Public Schools district boundaries never shifted. So we never took in any part of the Mason District, Jefferson.
Right.
So our internal boundaries did shift. And so, for example, let's say that there was one time people made comments in meetings about Waterloo. You know, should Waterloo have stayed open? Not stayed open. Had Waterloo been a closed building? So had Waterloo not been a building anymore, that area gets split up into the Manor, Raisinville, and all the other areas, right? And so when the Raisinville, so when we look at the different areas in our district, I couldn't tell you if that area up in this area that we're talking about was always Raisinville or if it had been other parts because of the size of the district years ago. That's why the township would have never known, but because we're talking about our inter-district lines on our elementary buildings.
Because it's changed quite, like, several times that I've worked here, that lines have shifted to rebalance the size of the schools. And
it does affect homeowners, and it does affect the sellability of homes within those areas. And so, you know, for me, that if all of our schools were operating at the same capacity and the same level, so when someone looked it up, they went, oh, okay, it doesn't matter which elementary school I go, but that's not the case right now. Mm-hmm. And so, and that case changes because, a lot of things. Yeah. And so, yeah, I literally had conversations with realtors who said we weren't aware of this.
Yeah.
And so when did this go into effect? How does this go into effect? I said, I have no idea. And so there are things that are going to be impacted immediately from this. So what are those things? I'm sharing with you those things that are impacted immediately. And I don't think people are aware of that.
But then, so I would also then say that as a district, then we would be able to make any decisions about any kind of lines. Or should the whole district be Raisinville School District? But that's about home sales.
It's just with the current structure as it is, and the capacity and the way that the schools are rated within Monroe County, Raisinville has always been rated and talked about as being the best school, and I don't think I'm misspeaking on that.
Not anymore.
So it was always listed.
The trouble, you know.
And Arborwood has a special focus. I use a long term.
I know so.
The focus should be that we make every school at the same level, which is part of why as we go through the restructuring, mm-hmm. and we start looking at the resources so that there's no difference between a Raisinville
right.
and an Arborwood.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I think the argument
for our realtors is more about looking at where we're at today than where we were a few years ago. The problem we have is how slow it takes for the data to catch up. I mean, I think it's one and a half years behind out there. The rating scales, when you go on there, you click on it, okay, what's it? No, it's not.
And in this market, you'd have to, I can't imagine, if someone said they didn't want to sell because of that, I'd get a different realtor. Because if you can't sell a house in 2 weeks now,
right.
I don't care what
so, the that's not the conversation. The conversation is, it did impact those homes. I don't know to the point that people are aware of this. I went to township supervisor, because that's my township supervisor, and that's where I live, and I asked him about it. I went to a realtor and asked them about it. So I'm they were like, they had no idea. So I'm not suggesting that a realtor can't sell a house. What I'm suggesting is that it does change the narrative, and it does change it. So right now, everything is listed in Raisinville School District. So it led me back to you and said, how is this going to be implemented? When did it become effective? And how are people going to know this? Because it matters.
So as far as...
Well, it was communicated.
But I don't want to tell someone that. So a realtor says, they pull it up online here in Basinville Township. You know how they list that all up?
But I'm not sure.
But they can go.
Raisinville Township.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Raisinville School. Yeah.
But you can go.
I'm just using them as an example.
Yeah. The realtor can go to the website, which has the redistricting.
It does. But I'm thinking
they don't know about it.
I believe that was why this is Us Night started, was to tell people about all the good things that the district is doing.
Well, no, just how the whole district.
The map wasn't put out, so we didn't know.
Those inter-district lines are always fluid. If you remember, before we were on the board, they were going to change the redistricting between Arborwood and Raisinville. And Chestnut Hills was going to go to Raisinville.
Right.
Reverend Boone, in particular, was concerned because that's primarily Hispanic-speaking students, and she didn't feel... the resources were there at Raisinville that we had at Arborwood. So we did adjust that, but that was based on student needs, not on housing. You can't change things based on housing values.
So again, how is that communicated? Are people just assumed to know? I mean, I'm just asking.
If you're buying a house, you should check it out with the school district.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What I don't know.
I never called the school district. I just looked at what it said.
Yeah, I don't know who updates at the.
Right.
I don't know who updates their maps. Say, okay, this is it's all Monroe Public Schools, but is it for elementary their boundaries? I don't know that.
So if someone put a house up for sale today,
mm-hmm.
I'm selling my house, so this is why it's relative, like right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Am I putting Raisinville? I mean, it's just true, and or
you're
am putting I
putting Monroe Public Schools? Yeah.
So you have to list what elementary school.
How do the entities break down the boundaries? I mean,
so when you sell a house, they say what school district, the nurse from the school district, what elementary school would you be associated with?
Yep.
So my question still is, it's really a simple question. So if I say Arborwood, right, which is what I said, it's Arborwood, and they're like, what do you mean? This is Raisinville.
I know
how did that information get out there? If they only hear the way they did it, then that's the way we do it.
Educating themselves about
I
think that's the point.
We do have the boundary maps on our student registration page on the website for what that's worth.
I usually
send
them the map.
A lot of times we do get calls from realtors to our reception desk. And they look things up.
Yeah.
So the reception desk and student services are well versed on that.
But you share with your realtor that?
That was my question.
But it is on our website.
But we didn't reach out to them.
So realtors do call you.
I mean, I bought mine thinking my kids would go to town.
So realtors. They can be adjusted. They can be fluid in whatever way the district thinks. It has nothing to do with the township. And yes. Realtors know to call in the school and find out.
That's over. The old ones. Right. So I was going to say there will be more clarity, you know, once we've rolled over into the new year, because then that'll be the other place you
for
can
our families.
Up, but
yeah. So yes, to answer
that
your question, our families internally, because kids in the system, would know. As far as anyone externally, they would have to. The way you'd find out is literally that. You talk to people that have it going on. Mm-hmm. Or you
she just explained
review.
It well.
Yeah.
Don't you think so?
I heard, yes.
Yeah, I thought she explained it. But that was my question right there.
Okay. Any other board members have any commentary? Okay. So that includes our agenda. We have a motion to adjourn.
I move that we adjourn this meeting.
I'll show hands. Okay, the Maryland Public School Board of Education.